Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we're going to return to a topic we've talked about a few times in the past, but I think, Susan, it's probably been at least 6 months.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Since we've given any attention to the subject of Medicare, Medicaid, and specifically a focus on Medicaid. But I want to distinguish the two because so many people confuse them, and they're very different programs. But we also wanted to talk about some of the practical ways in which Medicaid may be helpful to you. It's not to everyone. It's intended to target people specifically who are needy, for the most part, blind, disabled. But clearly there is opportunity for people who aren't quite fully broke, but mm-hmm. who have some assets they've accumulated over the course of their life, perhaps they're middle class, as that term is defined, and they would like to have something to pass along to their loved ones. So they often are interested. We have clients regularly who are interested in talking about, is Medicaid something that I should aspire to using to help pay for my long-term care costs, et cetera. Some people decide at the outset, no, this isn't for me. There are too many rules, too many limitations. I don't like limitations, restrictions. So I'd rather pay the bill myself and just hope that I don't end up in long-term care. If I do, I hope I'm not in there long. And maybe that's a good place to start this discussion. Okay, so let's start with that discussion. What about the question of trying to, I guess, handicap or forecast the probability that you're going to end up in long-term care? I mean, let's face it, whenever we're talking about Medicaid, even though there is incidentally something called home and community-based Medicaid, which is specifically for people who are homebound or who are not likely to go into long-term care, but no question, they meet those activities of daily living. We've talked about those before, those five or six things that allow you to qualify, not only for Medicaid, Medicare, triggering insurance provisions for long-term care. It's kind of a universal point of reference for qualifying for various forms of health care benefits.
And those are very simple, basic daily things, like ability to feed themselves, ability mm-hmm. to care and wash and take
yeah.
care of their
toileting.
I mean,
transferring to and from bed.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's this additional layer of what are called instrumental activities of daily living that relate to things such as being able to transport yourself or being able to actually prepare your meals, et cetera. Versus a basic activity would be eating, and that means literally assisting with eating, not the ability to cook a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone meets three of those for purposes of acceptance into a long-term care facility, then that would make them eligible for Medicaid, at least as to that prong. And then, of course, there are the financial issues. But the need issue, quite frankly, for qualifying for this, whether it's through your private insurance or through Medicaid, is really not a big obstacle. For the most part, if you struggle with those things, you're going to be able to demonstrate.
So a physician would normally have to sign off on that, maybe? Or
a physician or a senior care worker through the state of Missouri would come in if the issue is related to home and community-based care through Medicaid. Most people aren't familiar with that program because it hasn't gotten attention in the past. I mean, but most
I was just thinking, maybe we should do a program on that. I don't know much about that one.
Yeah, well, it is getting a push through the state of Missouri. The state of Missouri is clearly wanting people to pursue assistance in a way that minimizes the cost to the taxpayer. I mean, the bottom line is the taxpayer spends a ton of money in long-term care benefits. And this is going to become a crisis nationally. It's being debated now. Bernie Sanders, of course, his solution is to have a single provider system, and in which people would be able to get Medicare essentially without limitation, and it would apply to everyone, and it would include long-term care.
That, I'm not sure how he'd pay for that.
But. I know. That's probably not feasible. And even if it is feasible, it's probably not something we want. But in any case, it is a subject of national debate. And as we have this demographic tidal wave that we've been witnessing from baby boomers, I think this is going to go on for at least another, according to the calculations, what, another 15
or 20 years, I think.
Yeah, but before we get past those people who were born up to age 64. So home and community-based Medicaid is an alternative to the much higher cost of paying for institutional care. Institutional care estimates can run from $5,000 a month to $12,000 to $15,000 a month if you're in the best facilities. So, and of course, everybody wants to be in the best facilities. Mm-hmm, they want to be the best, at least the best they can afford. So home and community-based care is an alternative. The criteria by which you qualify, apart from the activities of daily living, which are very similar to those that you'd use in a institutional setting, but the main issue is the fact that you qualify a little differently. The asset requirements are the same, but it now requires an income-based consideration that wasn't necessary when you're talking about institutional care. So qualifying for it is a little different. It doesn't mean it's harder. It just means, though, that it's different. Whereas with the institutional care is something that most people are familiar with that process, and you also have people who work within these institutions whose job it is to help you qualify. Not all institutions take Medicaid, but I can tell you certainly the majority do. Mm-hmm. Though an institution in agreeing to accept Medicaid patients, they do agree to accept less money than they would from the non-Medicaid. However, they have certainty of payment. They have consistency. There's a lot of things that are advantageous to that they most institutions don't choose to pass on that. Mm-hmm. Now, they won't have certified all their beds. They can choose how many they want to certify.
Can they? I was going to say, is it always a percentage, or can they just say we want 10 beds or going to be Medicaid beds or something like that?
Yeah, it's often a percentage, but I've seen it where it's specified as a specific number, specific okay. beds themselves. Now, I don't want people to get the impression, as many might, that, oh, this means that these are inferior in some way. They're going to get less attention, less care. I can tell you that the rules are harsh, the penalties substantial. If there's any discrimination between somebody who's receiving Medicaid in a facility and those who are not. So I can't promise you that it never occurs. I've had clients who've occasionally suggested to me that they remember when their mother or father was in a place that probably more rural Missouri, but where they felt that there wasn't equal care. And I won't suggest that never happens. I suggest that today it's far less common, number one. And number two is there is a fix. And if you have families who are engaged, as we recommend all in families be, whenever you have somebody inside any institutional setting, whether it's a hospital or long-term care, when you have people engaged, I can tell you that's far less likely to occur.
Oh, sure. The more active you are and the more you're seen at the facility,
the better off
you're going to be.
Lots of remedies. So let's talk about basic. I'll begin by distinguishing between Medicare and Medicaid generally. Medicare, remember, is health insurance. Medicaid is not health insurance. Medicare is intended to focus primarily on people, of course, who are 65 or older. Its purpose is to pay for treatment of an injury or an illness. And that's an important word, treatment. Rehabilitation, improvement. I mean, that's the concept that we have of health care, as opposed to some sort of custodial care. Custodial care is when, yes, you might need things that are medical in nature, but it's really a matter of sustenance. There's no effort to fix you or to cure you. You've just, in our classic case here, you've gotten old, and mm-hmm. things don't work as well as they did. You can't take care of yourself as well as you did, so you need to be in this setting that will require medical parts of your care will be medical in nature, of course. It doesn't mean that it qualifies for Medicare because it doesn't mean that it's treatment for an injury or an illness in which there's an expectation that with this treatment you get better, you improve, et cetera. So I want to distinguish that. And some people are confused when they've had a loved one in a hospital, and the hospital says, well, we can't keep them now. We've got to move them to a rehab facility.
Mm-hmm. That happens all the time.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're trying to comply with rules. So when they go into this rehab facility, which incidentally can be a part of the hospital itself,
mm-hmm.
or it can be a part of a long-term care facility, what we call a nursing home. They often mm-hmm. have rehab sections. And they, you'll notice, many of our listeners, I suspect, have been through this process. You notice that they're very insistent that the person there participate in the rehab program.
They take you to physical therapy whether you want to go or not.
Yeah, I mean, kicking and screaming sometimes. Uh-huh. And I've observed in my family where often the people don't want to go.
That's exactly right.
But they're told, no, you need to do this. And in part of the reason, apart from their general improvement in health,
uh-huh.
which, of course, we want to be the primary concern, but also important is the funding. These facilities, remember, if they fail to be improving, to be rehabbing, et cetera, then they no longer fall within the definition required of Medicare to mm-hmm. be paid. And Medicare will pay in long-term care facilities, remember, up to 100 days. The first 20 days, I think it pays 100%. The remaining 80, I think it pays maybe 80%.
Mm-hmm.
You can check those percentages. But I can tell you that Medicare is insistent that they not be sucked into, drawn into paying for traditional long-term care, for nursing home mm-hmm. care for people as they age.
Mm-hmm.
And in fairness to them, they don't have the budget for that. So whenever your loved one gets transferred to a rehab facility, there needs to be things going on that resembles rehabilitation, because rehabilitation counts as treatment for an injury or illness. And if they quit participating, then they can no longer qualify for Medicare coverage.
Well, and I know I have talked to many people who suddenly find themselves in that situation, just as you described. They start out with an injury, then they have to move to the rehab center. But at some point, because they're older, they're not improving as quickly as someone younger might. And then they're in that situation where they're faced with, okay, you have to start getting better or you have to leave. And boy, you know, it feels terrible because
yeah.
they're not improving on purpose. They just are older. It's taking time. It's not there. They're not sure if that's where they're going to stay. And, you know, you see people cursing Medicare, Medicaid, you know.
Well, they're caught in this bureaucracy.
They are very caught in the middle.
And it's very complicated to understand. Even for somebody who is familiar with the system, they have to go and have conversations with several key people, often at several different entities, or maybe the hospital, maybe a long-term care facility, probably a government official, perhaps through a local Medicaid or Medicare office. So it can be difficult to figure out, even for people who generally understand the protocol, et cetera. So in order to avoid being hit with a requirement to start writing a check for, say, $10,000 a month, you have to be careful and dot your I's and cross your T's. Now, I can tell you that every long-term care facility has people on their staff whose full-time job
mm-hmm.
whose full-time job is to attend to being sure that this happens, because they recognize that a good portion of their patients cannot afford this.
Right.
And if they can't afford it, even if they can, a good portion of them would object.
Right.
And they would much rather get the check without hassle from the federal government, know that when they go to the bank with it, it's not going to bounce, et cetera. So whenever you currently are receiving Medicare, you have to be conscious of the fact that it has its limitations. And as long as there's an improvement, you're going to be within that coverage. But at some point, many of us will get to where we will not be able to go home, not because we're going to continue rehabilitation,
mm-hmm.
but because we need long-term care.
Right.
In that traditional sense of the word.
Right.
You know, like you may be told your dad's he's gotten as good as he's going to get. He's just going to need, ongoing professional medical care.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're hearing phrases like that, then you can be sure that probably the direction things are going is toward long-term care. And it means figuring out an alternative funding source. Let me mention one other thing, just because it's a pitfall for many people, is there is a requirement that before Medicare will pay for the rehab period, that additional 100 days, there has to be an institutional stay, a hospital stay, of 3 consecutive days. And the way that's calculated, the way that's calculated is three overnights. So many people, a lot of people have fallen victim to believing that because their loved one was held in the hospital, that they were qualifying, so that they were there maybe for what would amount to this three midnights is a better way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
If your loved one is there for three midnights, then they're going to meet that requirement. So they believe that they've qualified and they get into long-term care and they find out they haven't. And it turns out that what it was that stay was not an admission. It was they were placed in a status where they were watched or they were held.
Oh.
And this used to be very common. They may have been held in the emergency room. They may have even been moved to a room, but they were not admitted to the hospital.
So how do you find that out?
Well, usually they'll use language to indicate, you know, we're just going to hold him for observation. Now, again, that doesn't set off alarms unless you know what that means in terms of the financing rules. But still, they'll say words like that. Hmm. So, well, we're not going to admit him yet. I think we just want to put him on an observation stay. And if you put aside gamesmanship, put aside financial considerations, there are reasons that somebody might go into an emergency room and they think maybe their heart is, mm-hmm. they're not concerned. They think there may be a problem, but if he gets through another 24, 48 hours, they're okay. So there's in the most innocuous circumstances, they might, and I remember this from days when I worked in an emergency room many years ago when I was in undergrad, you'd sometimes move that person to a back area where they could still be watched and whatnot, and they're out of the way. They weren't admitted to the hospital, and they might be there for over 24 hours.
Hmm.
But because, though, of the ramifications of this, and because sometimes hospitals are doing this with an eye to their census and their qualification for Medicare and Medicaid in other contexts, so they didn't want this to be gamed. So now there are rules, as of a year ago, rules came out in which Medicaid made it clear and Medicare made it clear that this cannot be a practice anymore and which is intended to impact any sort of qualification. So I don't know how they enforce that,
mm-hmm.
but I know that now it's watched with greater suspicion than it was at one time. So be conscious if you have a loved one who has entered the hospital and you think they've been there 3 days and now they're going from there into long-term care, which is a very common transition, they will fail to have coverage if they were not actually admitted and been there for the equivalent of 3 days.
Interesting. So, and again, this has got to be consecutive, right? So if
yeah.
you're there, you go home, you end up having more issues at home. I mean, that's happened.
Yeah.
People are sent home and then they realize, okay, something else has gone wrong. And then they're admitted for two. That still doesn't qualify.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to be consecutive. And keep in mind the importance of this. If somebody is going to go into long-term care for just, say, 90 days, I mean, if you can somehow meet that definition of rehabilitation,
mm-hmm.
then it may be that you only need 90 days. It may be you only need 100 days. We don't know how long people will be in long-term care.
Right.
I mean, under the saddest circumstances, somebody might go into long-term care and they may pass away after 3 to 6 months. So we don't want that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is we want that coverage for 3 months because we just don't know. Maybe after 3 months they're able to go home.
Mm-hmm.
So in circumstances that might be interpreted either way, there is room, and nursing homes are good at this. They can become your ally. Nursing homes can be very helpful to you. They'll have somebody on staff who's in charge of the qualification process to help you through Medicaid qualification or Medicare coverage, as the case may be. And they you should rely on them, and they can inform you of the rules. But it's in their interest, too, to help you qualify.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Most of the situations I've heard of in recent days, there is someone there who knows the ins and outs, who will help guide you from point A to point B. If you're not getting better and they think that you're going to need, they'll search for a nursing home to put you in, or they'll work to get you a bed, or they'll work to find you a facility where you can go.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that there was a very high-profile lawsuit which was brought, I don't think it was brought in the state of Missouri, but it got a lot of attention a few years ago. And the issue was, is it true that you have to show actual improvement in order to meet the criteria of Medicare for this 100-day period? Do you have to be identified as somebody who's actually improving? And the argument was that the language of Medicare said that if this treatment is necessary to keep someone at the same level, then it is sufficient. So there is room to get – there's lots of room for interpretation.
Okay.
And I want our listeners to know that whenever they're facing this transition from a hospital to some sort of long-term care for rehab, et cetera, there is an opportunity to interpret that as rehab and to allow them to have coverage for this critical period of time, even if it simply means that what's happening is without it, the person would clearly deteriorate. So it means some sort of activity or rehabilitation that is intended at best to keep them at the same level. But without it, there's no question they'd be worse. That has clearly been approved by the courts to meet the standards for Medicare coverage and rehabilitation. Okay, so let's take a break, and then we'll be back in a moment, and we'll talk about how these rules apply in actual cases. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome back. Another episode of Elder Talk. We're talking about Medicaid qualification. How does Medicaid work? How might it be helpful for many of you who think that you can't possibly qualify because it's just for poor people?
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And I have to admit that in its origins, that was its purpose. It was passed as part of the legislation that went through with LBJ in 1965. So its purpose was to help specifically poor people. But the law is written in a way that makes clear that it is possible to qualify without being broke. And rather than regarding this as an abuse or as an exploitation, instead think about it as you do the tax code. With the tax code, you feel, quite frankly, it's your responsibility as a steward of your money to not pay more taxes than you have to. So you feel perfectly justified in searching for
every deduction you possibly can find.
Deductions, exemptions, buying stocks, or rather buying bonds that are tax exempt, looking for opportunities to minimize your tax bill. So I suggest that's the way you approach this topic, is you want to utilize the law in a way to where you can be the good steward as you are of your funds. I mean, you have a responsibility to your family, perhaps to a church or synagogue, and I think that you should not pay more than you have to for your long-term care, just as you should not for taxes.
And so, Medicaid is a way to do that.
And Medicaid provides some opportunities, but it is a judgment call. And as we talked at the outset of the show, there is a little bit of guesswork, prognostication, when you think about, do I think that I'm going to, in fact, be in long-term care?
Mm-hmm.
So some people have a better sense of what lies ahead for them down the road than others. Some have had a diagnosis. And if you've had a diagnosis of certain things, you might think, well, there's a greater chance that I'm going to be in long-term care, whether it's Parkinson's or MS or, choose your example, Alzheimer's. Now, some of these people, incidentally, with MS and Parkinson's, they do fine. They live long lives, and they're okay. Others, you know, perhaps their particular form or strain or whatever, it's more crippling, perhaps, or more debilitating. So for people who feel that they can forecast with a higher degree of confidence that they're going to need long-term care, then they will choose to accept some of the constraints and some of the hassles that are required in order to qualify for Medicaid that others may not. So what are some of those things? Well, let me start by saying that contrary to the way Medicare, Medicaid works in some states, there is no income limit for Medicaid in Missouri. Now, it's kind of a self-correcting thing because in the state of Missouri, whatever you have in terms of quote-unquote available funds, so whatever your income is on a regular basis, that after submitting all of your financials, and it's a lot of documents, part of the qualification process, you should be aware of that. Anybody who's considering applying for Medicaid, be prepared to come up with your documents going back 5 years. But you've submitted all these documents, and there's been a conclusion reached by the representatives through the Medicaid office in Missouri that you have a certain amount of income. So
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. And so whatever the shortfall is from that number is what would be provided by Medicaid. So you can see why they don't have to look at your income for purposes of qualification. For example, if you qualified from an asset standpoint and you had $10,000 a month and your nursing home bill was $8,000, well, they stand ready to help you for your shortfall, but, oh, looks like you don't have
you
one.
You don't have one.
So it's a self-correcting thing. So that's the reason in the state of Missouri the way they do it, which makes sense to me, is that they don't say, oh, you make $4,000 a month, you don't qualify. Instead, they focus on your assets, and they make note of your income because they're only going to pay for the shortfall. You pay directly to the nursing home the amount of your available funds on a monthly basis.
And what types of things qualify as income?
Well, it is a weird definition in some ways. Let me first talk about the general rules. The general rules are it's the same, meaning that your income, your gross income is calculated. So they will look at salary. They'll look at what would have been salary. In this case now, it may be pension.
Mm-hmm.
They'll look at dividends. They'll look at interest income. All those traditional sources, even if you own a small business, they'll look at real estate income.
Okay.
So those things that most of us would know as income. Now, I'll tell you that what's weird is when you have sold an asset or something where you have this stream of money coming in, that can be counted as income in that year. So it does get a little wacky on the along the edges. But for the most part, you can just take income as you know it and assume that that's the way it will be interpreted by for purposes of qualification for Medicaid. Now, the real focus of attention is going to be on assets, your resources. Specifically, a phrase that's used is available resources. Now, many people are aware that they can own a house and it won't count against them.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly enough, you could have $550,000 equity in your home,
which is quite a bit.
For most people, yeah. It is, yeah. And for $550,000, you can have that in equity in your home and still qualify for Medicaid. Now,
okay, say that again. Say that because that kind of blows people's mind, don't you think?
It must.
You can have a $550,000 house.
Yeah,
and still qualify for Medicaid.
Yeah, and a lot of people aren't aware of that. And then when you think about it, though, then some people will say, "But wait, if I go into a nursing home, how do I get the benefit of that house? And then would I have to sell it?"
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that traditionally, that has been construed to mean that. Unless it's clear that someone is not returning to their home, they can still claim to have an intention to return and be able to keep it. Now, if Medicaid actually concludes that there is no reasonable chance that you'll return to that home, then actually before a person passes away, that house could be sold to offset some of the costs of their long-term care. All of it wouldn't be taken, just the amount that would be owed for the long-term care.
Okay.
But I can tell you, as a practical matter, it's often not tampered with. If the person has just made an assertion that it is my intention, rather than get into the details of figuring out what the probabilities are of their health care, et cetera, then it's just often left alone. And one reason it's left alone, two reasons actually. One is that the state and the federal government knows that when that person passes away, guess who comes along and makes a claim? Yeah, in the estate, the state of Missouri is required, in fact, by federal law. They have to show up. They have to assert a claim. They file it with the personal representative of the estate, the executor, and they assure that their claim is paid. And it's a federal claim, so it has a priority over a lot of other creditors that might exist because it's a federal governmental claim, federal and state, in fact. So there is some confidence on the part of the Medicaid people that they're going to get their money sooner or later. Now,
it's just a question of whether they get it while you're alive or from your estate.
Yes. However, there's often another factor. Is there a spouse living in that house at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Or are there other dependents? There may be dependents that could be adult dependent children, et cetera. Generally, you have to be under age. What was that age change to? I think it's under age 21.
Hmm.
But still, if they've been certified dependent, if they have a disability, et cetera, then they can qualify. In any case, so you have a spouse living there. As long as it's true that that spouse would be disrupted, that there would be hardship imposed on them if this house were sold, then that will not be collected at that point. That's a law in the state of Missouri that protects surviving spouses. Now, that's a pretty loose definition. When you read the statute, as I did just recently, I was surprised how amorphous it was. Mm-hmm. So I think the point is that we don't want to get into a battle in probate with a surviving spouse about taking their house now. So for the most part, that is deferred because the statute states that if it is disruptive, then they can wait until the death of the surviving spouse, then take the house. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people, when they're doing their estate planning, a big piece of their intention, a big concern is that they pass a house or their primary source of wealth to mm-hmm. their children. Mm-hmm. And the house is often it.
Right.
So it's not often very consoling for someone to hear what I've just explained, that, oh, if I end up in a nursing home, then the house will be okay until I die, or the house will be okay until my husband dies, because often their focus is really on their children. So I want to mention that a house is exempt, but I want people to understand when someone tells them that a house is exempt for Medicaid purposes, I want them to understand what that means. Mm-hmm. It's not what they might think it means. So people will often say, well, is there a way that I can protect my house? And then that raises questions about what are the alternatives. Now keep in mind, though, let's come back to this thing about forecasting, because it you can easily lose sight of the underlying purpose here in this conversation. And it's to try to arrange for payment of costs that would threaten all of your assets or a substantial part. Mm-hmm. Not everyone who goes into long-term care is there for 5 years. As a matter of fact, the average is just under 3 years.
Oh.
It's 2 years and 10 or 11 months. So close to 3 years mm-hmm. is an average. And that means that half the people are below that. So we might assume that 25% plus are going to be maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we're thinking about the sort of exertions that you would make in order to protect your assets, you need to assess what you think those probabilities are. None of us has a looking glass that will allow us to know for sure, but we need to think about it. But those who see that there is significant risk, those who simply are not willing to assume risk, they're very risk averse.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of personality is going to reach a different conclusion from somebody who, by their nature, is a risk taker. And there's something to be said, incidentally, for quality of life. Let's assume that people say, well, you know, I would like to have full care at home, and I'm willing to spend the money to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you need to know that if your goal is to die in your house, to the extent that it's at all possible, and that is more important really than protecting a nest egg for your children. Maybe your children are self-sufficient. Maybe you don't have children.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, if you engage in the efforts to do Medicaid qualification, you're going to move your assets around in such a way that's going to restrict your ability to use them later on. One of the ways which some people are familiar with, for example, placing assets in a trust. I won't get into the details of that right now, but I'll just suffice it to say that when you put assets in a trust, an irrevocable trust, it's going to limit your ability to use those in the future. It may protect them,
mm-hmm.
so your loved ones will have them, your children specifically, but it's going to restrict you and probably your spouse's access to those funds to a great extent. You might say, well, if my goal then is to be at home and to spend my last months in my house, and that's your citadel, as it's been termed by a couple of authors who've talked about the importance of aging in place, and,
mm-hmm.
and they feel that the citadel of autonomy, it was a phrase that was used in one of these books, to capture the importance that the house has to people as they age, often their home. Well, you need cash to do that.
Absolutely.
And you may be willing to spend the money that it might take, which could easily be $15,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, it's not as efficient to get the care that you'd get in a nursing home, which is in an institution where you have people who are one person is spreading their costs among 10, 15 patients on a floor, et cetera. All the efficiencies you have versus staying at home and trying to do that in the house. Remember, by its nature, it's going to be less efficient, and as a result, it's going to be more expensive probably.
Which I think is a little bit counterintuitive to what a lot of people think. I think there is a perception that if I'm staying at home, it's going to be cheaper.
Yeah, and I can see how at a glance you might think that, but as you ratchet up the level of care, as it becomes more, quote-unquote, medical, then the professionals who are coming in to do the things that they do, they're getting in cars, they're driving this one place, they're going in and doing these things. You can contrast that to walking down a hallway and stopping in each room.
Well, and it's probably also not just a home health worker. It might be more of an RN or someone
who's
got the additional training that they're going to be making more money.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, it generally involves, there is a home health worker who's not a nurse, who is there probably 24/7 at some point. And a nurse is probably not there 24/7, but you probably would have somebody such as a nurse or a nurse practitioner who would drop in periodically. I mean, this is not unrealistic for somebody for whom it's very important that they be in their home. It's not unrealistic if you're willing to invest the dollars, which will maybe a little more than you'd spend in a nursing home on a monthly basis. But why not? If you don't have obligations to your children or specific concerns, not to mention if you don't have kids, and if your kids are self-sufficient, then I think it's very reasonable and maybe to be encouraged that if it means that much to someone that they do that. So if that's your approach, then you don't want to do the sort of transactions that you would have to engage in order to qualify for Medicaid. Another issue, for example, in the Medicaid qualification process is to what extent do I spend down money?
Right. We've heard that phrase, spend down.
Yeah. And what that means is one of the arch violations that for purposes of qualifying for Medicaid is whenever you engage in a transaction where you give more than you receive. It's called an uncompensated transaction.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something that is thinly veiled where you transfer a piece of real estate worth $100,000 and you get $20,000 back. Now, my clients don't engage in transactions like that, and I'm going to say that probably the listeners would not either, but that's an illustration of an uncompensated transfer. Now, that can occur incidentally. It can occur accidentally. It's not unusual to have a transaction where it turns out later that when you turn over your records in your application process for Medicaid and they're looking back over 5 years, they say, wait, you know, you sold this house to your son, and do you have documents to show its value at the time? And maybe it looks like it was transferred much less than you intended. Maybe your intention was not to give it. Or maybe it was to give it. Incidentally, I don't want to suggest that people who engage in an uncompensated transfer, that it's always something insidious, that it may in fact have a very worthy and applaudable purpose, but it still doesn't change the fact that it's a gift, and gifts, transfers are forbidden, however they're made.
Well, we had a question come in. This is on a much smaller scale, but here was the question. They were wondering about a car, if willing or gifting a car can cause a Medicaid penalty. So I have a teenage driver, I'm just going to say, and we are looking for a car for him. So grandma and grandpa, if you're listening and you want to give him a car, like some of these grandma and grandpas do, that would be great. But so what this
was a good example.
What this one wanted to do is they gave the granddaughter, their car because they were not going to be driving anymore.
Right.
But what they're wondering is now is that incur a penalty in that 5-year look back period?
And I want to clear up the terminology because whenever I say that it's not a gift is not permitted or that here we use the word penalty, I don't want to suggest to our listeners that there's anything wrongful. I just mean whenever I say that there's a penalty associated with it or that it's not permitted, it just means that those are transactions that will be caught in that five-year look back for which you have to compensate, so to speak. You have a period where you essentially repay it by not qualifying. So if for example, you'd given away $30,000 and your nursing home cost was $10,000, so the way the formula works, that first 3 months, $10,000 each month, you would not qualify. So in effect, you kind of paid it back.
Right.
So that's all we're talking about. I don't want people to think that there's anything criminal or in that sense.
Good distinction.
Yeah. But as you mentioned with the grandparents, a very common scenario. Mm-hmm. My grandparents bought me a car.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they were not thinking about Medicaid qualification. But that is a case, though, where, yes, that's considered a gift, and it would be caught in this five-year look back. And what now is much more difficult than it was before 2008 is that when you have a five-year look back, you need to know that period starts from the moment that you make your application. So it's not 5 years from when you made the gift. So if you made the gift 4 years ago, you may think, well, oh, another year, and that's good. So if I go ahead and apply today, then it'll just be a year and I'll qualify. No, you would want to wait until the 5 years has gone by before you apply. Because if you apply within the 5 years, then you start a new period of having to make that up.
Oh, did not know that.
Yeah, it's a little complicated. Yeah. So obviously people who are considering Medicaid qualification need to use a lawyer. So let me finish up this picture, though, of the sort of compromises that you have to make. I think we have just a few minutes left, so I want to kind of leave our listeners with this idea that Medicaid is not a entirely free ride, or it's not a piece of cake in terms of the decision to pursue that qualification. It does mean that you have to plan. It means that you may be able to transfer some money into a trust in which there might be a five-year qualification period. So if you do it and you're in really bad health, then it may not be as effective as if you are doing it at a time when you think 60 months is reasonable or close to 60. It's still helpful if after 45 months you had to go into long-term care. It still would have been a helpful transaction. Things such as spending down money, it means you can't give it away, but you can spend it. So that's different. And so if you were to spend $100,000, an extreme example, on a world tour, and then you went into a nursing home, well, that's not a gift. That's permissible because you got value for it. You didn't give it away.
Maybe you should take your grandchildren with you.
Probably not.
Oh, meaning, that's not so good.
Well, the cost that would be attributable to the grandchildren would count as a gift.
Oh, man.
Yeah. These are tough rules. And there are various other things we could talk about, which in the next show we'll continue this discussion. Maybe we'll get to some of those. But the walk away here, I think, for many of our listeners is to think about the fact that Medicaid is something that will require you to make some concessions. It'll require you to engage in some planning, and that might interfere with what you otherwise would regard as your priorities for the balance of your life. But I will say this. I have had clients, I will continue to have clients for whom it's a number one priority, that they want to have assets that they hold on to for their children. In part, it's a matter of principle to them, the idea that they're giving up what they think is something for which they should be a better steward, that they're having to essentially go through the fortune, small it might be, that they've accumulated over their life. And so for them, it's a determination that I'm not going to see my money go in that way. And for them, fine. Medicaid is, assuming they meet the other criteria and they're willing to make the concessions, whatnot, then it's probably the thing for them. But it's not for everybody. I want our listeners to keep that in mind. So let's take the next show, Susan, and let's dedicate it to a continuing discussion of Medicaid qualification. We'll talk a little bit more about the details of qualifying. I'll try not to get into the weeds. You don't need somebody to act as your individual lawyer when you listen to shows like this because no one can anticipate your particular situation. What you want to get is the broad features mm-hmm. of what the rules are, so that when you go to your lawyer, and you should go to somebody who does a lot of this, elder law, Cordell Planning Partners does this. There are other lawyers in the area that do this, but focus on attorneys who work in this area, but place before them some of the questions that perhaps you've gotten as you've listened to this show and some of the ideas you have, and then let them explain to you whether or not it's applicable to you and your particular situation. So until next time, this has been another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.